you, Marilyn. Okay, this brings us to the main part of our program. And I would like to introduce Rob Perez, reporter for the Honolulu Advertiser, who came out last month with the, this month?
March.
It was last month with the incredible series on the problems facing elders needing services that, here it is, March 28th, 31st was the series. So I'll ask Rob to please say a few words about himself and his work and this project in particular, and then on into his presentation.
Thanks, Larry, and thank you for inviting me today to speak. For those of you who don't know me, I've been in the journalism business for about 30 years now. Most of that has been doing investigative or enterprise type of reporting. I don't typically get involved in the day-to-day breaking news, the murders, the court trials, things like that. I have established a track record of being able to do a good in-depth enterprise reporting, and so that's what my editors asked me to focus on. I'm actually quite flattered that anyone would be interested in hearing my thoughts on Hawaii's long-term care system, because until recently, I would venture to say that most of you in this room knew a lot more about it than I did. But one of the benefits of working for a newspaper that values investigative reporting is that a reporter can be given sufficient time to be able to really delve into a particular topic in search of stories. And that's precisely the opportunity I was given last year when my editors asked me to look into the long-term care system. Initially, it was going to be a series of stories just on the nursing home industry, because I don't know if you folks are subscribers to the Advertiser, but in early, I think it was in January of 2009, I had written a story about she was 81 at the time, a resident of a nursing home, and she was left abandoned at the Straub Hospital at the ER room. And I wrote about that story, and because of that, the nursing home was eventually fined because they handled that situation inappropriately, even though there were some serious issues, like her family had stopped paying the nursing home bill, and the family owed, I think it was in excess of $30,000 to the nursing home, which is, a serious problem for the nursing home, but they just went about dealing with it in a way that the feds said wasn't appropriate. When I did that story, I proposed to my editors, why don't we take a closer look at the nursing home industry to look at quality of care issues, to look at whether this is a something that's not isolated that happens, just given the demographics of the state. I figured it would probably be a topic that would have lots and lots of interest. Well, my proposal was, why don't I do some initial legwork, come back with an idea maybe for a two or three part series, and we'll see where it goes from there. They said, no, Robert, we actually want you to think a little bit broader. We want you to look at the whole continuum of care in the long-term care industry outside of the home. The series didn't look at in-home care, which is something that, as I mentioned later, I'm going to get to next. So basically, I was given 4 or 5 months off and on to really delve into this topic. And that's a luxury, and it is a luxury in this day and age in newspapers, that few other reporters have, to be able to spend several months focusing almost exclusively on one topic. Fortunately, my editors allowed me to do that. And what I found was fairly disturbing. It disturbed me, it disturbed my editors, and so we decided to do a four-part series looking at the broader long-term care system outside the home. When Larry asked me to come today to talk to you, he asked what I should entitle the presentation, and my response was, why don't we pose the question, are we ready for the coming silver tsunami? And if you read my series, I think the answer would have to be a resounding no. We are far from ready. I'm not going to go into recounting all the things I found about this, all the flaws I found about the series today. If anyone hasn't read it and you're interested, you can go onto our website, and all the stories and graphics and photos are available for you to peruse. But what I did want to say is that virtually everywhere I looked in the system, I found major problems. Problems that clearly compromise the safety net for the very people that the system is supposed to protect. I was shocked to the extent of the problems that I found, and was telling my editors, you know, I think we're, you know, onto something here. I think we can, you know, really develop a good series. But that's not to say, though, that the entire system is broken. If you do your homework, you can find excellent care in both big institutions and the small mom and pop operations if you do your homework. And healthcare professionals, patients, and their families all told me as much, and that was reflected in the series. Because one of the things I didn't want to do is you to use a broad brush to basically condemn the whole system. But it was just as clear from my reporting that the system was plagued with numerous problems. And it almost, for me, was the challenge was, what do I focus on? I mean, there were so many flaws in the system. It was difficult for me to hone in on, okay, what, because I couldn't cover everything. And so it was difficult for me to sort of self-act and decide what it was I should focus on. But it was the flaws in the system that's what I wanted to focus on. Because to my way of thinking, if there isn't general recognition about what is wrong with the system, if there isn't general recognition about those flaws, it makes it much, much more difficult to gather the resources and the political will to solve those problems, especially in these tough economic times today. It's not enough, in my view, to simply say we value our kapuna and we're going to care for them in their golden years, because clearly, based on what I found, we were falling far short of that mark. And I would say it's a situation where if we don't address those problems today, not 6 months from now, not a year from now, if we don't start seriously addressing them today, the situation is going to get far worse as the demands on our system intensify, as you and are fully aware that our elderly population is, you know, rapidly growing at a clip that surpasses most other states. So although I'm not going to recount what I found in the series, I did want to share a little bit with you today about the kind of response I got, because I think it was very telling. Every day during the week that the series ran, I would come into my office and there would be my phone voicemail would be blinking, and every single day it would be filled to capacity. And then I would go through the messages, you know, take notes on them, return people's phone calls, and then clear my voicemail. And then invariably during the day, I would have to go, you know, out for an interview or something, and I'd be gone for 2 hours. I would come back, and there's my light flashing again. my voicemail was completely full again. And that happened every day the series ran for that entire week. I have never, in all the things that I've done for both the advertiser, I've been with the advertiser since 2005, and for the Star Bulletin, and I was with the Star Bulletin for about 15 years, I've never gotten a response, at least via telephone, like that, where every time I turned around, my voicemail was full. And I might add, I'm continuing to get lots and lots of phone calls from people. A lot of the callers wanted me to look into a situation involving one of their loved ones. Some of them, you know, were pleading with me and actually in tears, asking if I could look into the situation. There were a lot of callers who just wanted to vent, say they were frustrated with dealing with the system, and they just wanted to share that with me. There were a lot of callers who, and probably this is the most response I got, who called simply to say thank you, simply to say there's so little independent, reliable, in-depth information about the long tail case system that they just wanted to thank me. And they were hoping that the advertiser would continue writing about this topic. And what I told them, particularly in light of what has happened in recent weeks with the possible sale of the advertiser and the possible closure or sale of the Star Bulletin, is as long as I'm a journalist in this town, and I don't know how much longer that will be, this is a priority for me. This is something that it's clear there's an interest out there. It's clear that there's a big vacuum of good, reliable, independent information. And it's something that I would like to continue writing about, you know, as I remain a journalist, and I don't know how long that's going to be. But even now, I'm working on some follow-ups based on the ideas I got from people when they called, you know, once the series was published. And in fact, I was getting calls during the series, one of which I got a call from a gentleman who told me that, Rob, did you know that the care homes here, there is no requirement to get general liability insurance? And I at first thought, now you're pulling my leg. There's got to be. There's such a potential for clients to get hurt either through negligent care or because there's some kind of hazard in the house. They trip over something. And the idea that these care home operators are not required to get liability, I just thought that the guy was pulling my leg. But I made a couple of phone calls, and sure enough, he was right. And so by the end of the week, we had a front page story about that very issue. And so there are other another idea that I got was, Rob, the series dealt with care outside of the home. There's a lot of us seniors who are considering care inside the home. We want to hire caregivers to come to our homes because we would rather age in our own homes. I know that's and I intentionally, just because when you're doing a project like this, you have to limit the focus of it, because otherwise it'll just be all over the map, and you know, I'd be writing about it for weeks, and it's just not workable. You have to have a certain amount of focus and stick to that focus. So I intentionally stayed away from dealing with the issue of in-home care. But I got so many calls from people asking about that part of the system that I have, even as we speak, I'm working on doing probably just a single story, a follow-up that looks at in-home care in Hawaii, where the regulatory gaps are, what some of the problems are, what works about the system and what doesn't work about the system. So if any of you have ideas in that arena, I would be happy to hear them, because that's something I'm focusing on right now. And I mean, I have a whole list of ideas based on what the kind of feedback I got. Like I said, it's feedback that rivals anything that I've ever done before. That I, you know, I want to continue writing about long-term care issues, you know, for some time. One reason why it took me, like I said, I worked on this project off and on for about 4 or 5 months, and in my business, that's quite a lot of time to devote to a subject. It's a very costly form of reporting, a very time-consuming form of reporting, and the time I'm spending looking into, you know, issues like that means it's time I can't be spending helping do the daily coverage. So the editors at the paper have to make a deliberate conscious decision that, you know, we think this type of reporting is worth enough to the newspaper to be able to free someone like myself to do, you know, these projects. And that, by and large, is what I do most of the time. And in this case, if you talk even to professionals who have been in the business for a long time, they will be the first to tell you that, Rob, this system is, it's confusing, it's convoluted, it's difficult to navigate, and can you imagine what it's like for families who are navigating it for the first time? And so, I mean, I made that a part of my series, you know, that was one part of the series, but I mentioned that just to let you know why it takes so long to do these kinds of projects, because I, as the writer, have to develop enough of an expertise where I feel comfortable writing authoritatively about the subject. And that's not an easy thing to do, particularly if you're coming into the subject, you know, relatively cold and not knowing a whole lot about it. So I, over the course of those 4 or 5 months, I talked to close to 100 different people, caregivers, nurses, physicians, care home operators, foster home operators, nursing home managers, regulators, legislators, and just as importantly, if not more importantly, the patients and residents of these facilities and their families. So I talked to, like I said, close to 100 people. Some of them I had to go back 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 times, sometimes I think a dozen times, to interview them, just because a new issue would come up that I would want to bounce off them, or I needed to make sure what I had was accurate, or there were new angles that cropped up in the course of my reporting that I had to bounce off of people. Because when you do projects like this, nuance and context is critical. You have to present the information in a way that provides proper context, and also in a way that basically makes it bulletproof from people. Because I know whenever I do these kinds of projects and I'm taking either an individual to task or an institution to task or a government agency to task, believe me, when you've done enough of these projects, when they're published, people read through them line by line with a fine-tooth comb to look for any way to undermine the validity of either the general premise of the story or any aspect of it, so they can try and undermine, you know, my credibility. And I expect that. And in fact, one of the things I do when I'm doing a project like this is, after it's all done, after all the editors have taken a look at it, I spend a few hours going through and reading it, trying to force myself to be a critic of the story, of the project. So I'm reading it as if I'm the caregiver being taken to task. I'm the institution being taken to task. I'm the industry being taken to task. And try and read it from that perspective and say, how can we undermine Rob's work? Because you have to be able to go, you have to go through that exercise in order to make the story stand up to criticism, stand up to all the people that are going to try and pick it apart. And I fully expect that, and I don't begrudge anyone to do that, because it's just, it's part of when you're doing these kinds of enterprise reports, it just comes with the territory. And when people call to challenge me on something, even if at the end of the day, I explain to them why I did something and they say, okay, Rob, that makes sense, it makes me a better reporter for the next time I do something, because it allows me to sort of think of things in a different light. So anyway, when I do these, whether it's this project or any of the other many projects I've done, you've got to try and present information in a way that you can easily defend it if someone's taking you to task. And believe me, I've been taken to task many, many times. So it's a critical, critical part of what I do. In addition to talking to, close to 100 people, for this particular project, I probably looked at more than 3,000 documents. 3,000 pages of documents, so let me correct that. And that was nursing home reports, care home inspection reports, foster home inspection reports, court cases. And that's a lot of times where you get some of your best information is in these documents that a lot of times most people won't, they'll never see the light of day. They're, usually tucked away in some government office in a filing cabinet, which is one of the reasons why part of the series I prominently mention a bill that you folks are probably somewhat familiar with that was introduced the last couple of it wasn't introduced this session plus the session before that and the session before that, and that's to put the these inspection home reports online, which at least 17 other states do. And I think it would be a great idea here, because when you look at the foster homes and the care homes, which represent about half of the long-term care beds here in this state, there is virtually no information that's readily available to consumers to be able to judge whether this home is an appropriate one for a loved one. And I think that that's appalling. When there's information out there, it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be the end-all and be-all for someone to make a decision on what care home to use or foster home to use, but it's a valuable tool in a toolbox that one can use to evaluate whether this care home or foster home is appropriate for a loved one. And that's one of the reasons why I included that in my reporting. I think that basically is the message, what I wanted to say. It was a difficult project to put together. I was very pleased with how it came about. I think there was lots of good information that we provided to people, and then based on the feedback, I just think there's a real hunger for more of this kind of information that I intend to pursue as long as I'm employed as a journalist in this town. Anyway, thanks for your time, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Sure. Rob, first of all, let me add my voice to the many you've had on. Thank you for the work you
appreciate
did, and I'm looking forward to your next report. This is a pipe dream for the follow-up report after the one on in-home care in Hawaii. I am a big believer in not reinventing the wheel and learning from others. I doubt this is really feasible, but I would love to see you do something on what is being done elsewhere, what is being done right and wrong. Mm-hmm. How do I've had people who have been involved in long-term care in other states say that we may be better than a lot of states, mm-hmm. and particularly the foster care, for example. I've had several people say we should have something like that. But what is happening not only in the rest of the country, but in the rest of the world? How do people handle these issues in different cultures and different societies? What is there for us here in Hawaii to learn from what others have already done?
That's a very good point. And if I think, if I did a postmortem on the series, I think that's probably one of the areas where I fell short. I wish I would have provided some more context on how these types of issues are being handled elsewhere, either, you know, successfully or not. Right, yes. That's right. That's a very good point, because if I would have went to my head, I want to, instead of a 4-day series, I want to make this a 5-day series, and I want to devote just one day to examining how other places do this. I'm shuddered to think what they might have told me, because they would have said, "You mean you need more time?" Well, then you're really talking pipe dream, given the economics of newspapers today.
Rob, I'm wondering what kind of pushback you've gotten from people who may have found things in the series that they did not like or they did not agree with.
I actually have been very, very surprised, because of all the feedback I've gotten, including emails and letters, I would say 95% of it has been very positive. The one common criticism I heard was that, mainly from the care home people, was that, Rob, even though you tried to not use a broad brush to paint this picture for the entire industry, When people walked away from that series thinking, this is what they were telling me, people walked away from that series thinking all care homes are bad. And that was probably the most common criticism I got for the series. And I told them that, you know, you probably have a point to some degree, but the whole point of the series was to focus on what's not working. Because as I mentioned, that's the only, if there isn't a general recognition of the problem, you know, we're never going to solve it. And so, but I, you know, the people who shared those criticism with me, I said, you know, you have some valid points, and hopefully the next time I can ponder those a little more closely and reflect them in what I write.
TJ Davies.
Oh, hi, Mr. Davis.
Is there anything to be inferred by the delay in publishing in December before the legislature opened and publishing in April, three quarters of the way through the legislative session?
I wish
you can talk about it.
I mean, I can. I wish I could tell. I mean, well, I don't wish it, but there was no devious attempt to sort of undermine the series or... it wasn't intentional. One of the things when you do a project like this, one of the things that we measure in terms of how successful it is whether it results in change, positive change. And anything I do in terms of these big projects, that's always one of my sort of main goals, is I don't want to spend months working on a project unless I think it can result in some positive change for the community. I would venture to guess, to sort of provide a little bit of background, I finished the series, and for some of you who I've talked to and interviewed in the months as I was working on the series, I actually finished the series in late November. I turned in all my stories. They were done. The response I got to, and the idea was to have it run before the end of the year and prior to the legislative session, because that's when it could have probably its greatest impact. Well, for a variety of reasons, the initial explanation by my editors was, Rob, this is a very good series. What you found is very disturbing. And what the last thing we want to do is rush into this and rush it into the paper and just not do it right. Don't give it the treatment that it warrants. So after I turned in my stories at the end of November, the decision was made that, well, a second point I also had to mention is we all agreed, myself included, that this is not, the series was kind of a downbeat topic, so this was not something that we wanted to run at Christmas time. You know, we didn't want to do something like this, run it the week of Christmas. And so it was a given that it wasn't going to run around the holidays. So that meant that the choice for us was either, remember, I turned in the stories, the last of the stories, the end of November. And that meant the decision for us was either to rush it in like that first half of December or wait until after the holidays. Well, we sat around and discussed whether getting it in before mid-December was feasible. And we probably could have done it, but it would have been a really rushed job. And when you're doing a project of this magnitude and you have people spending literally months working on it, and it's not just me. There's other people doing – I mean, there's – all kinds of moving parts to a project like this. And so there's other people working just as hard trying to get it all to put all the pieces together to present it to our readers. And that the decision was just made that it would be taking too much of a chance to run it by mid-December because it would have been too much of a rush. And I, as much as I wanted it in December, I said, no, I can fully understand that. And I think I'm on board with that because, you know, the last thing you want to do is rush it in and have something wrong with it. And then it sort of undermines the credibility of the whole series. So we decided we're going to wait until after the holidays. And to me, I thought that meant, okay, we'll run it in, you know, mid-January maybe. Well, I think it's just one of those things that in the newspaper business, you know, we are probably among the worst in terms of internal communications. And I don't want to say it slipped through the cracks, but it never got to the point where we were ready to run it. And believe me, I kept bugging my editors, what's happening to the series? And it just didn't rise to the top of the priority list with all the other things that were going on. And then, you know, this bombshell of an announcement on the sale of the newspaper happened, and I was wondering, oh, no, is that going to derail the series entirely? But fortunately, we were able to get it in. But that's sort of a long-winded answer. I personally would have rather seen it run prior to the legislative session because I think it would have had possibly some immediate impact, but it didn't, and that's all I can say about it. But by the same token, that's why to me it's important to continue writing about this issue, so it's not something that people just forget about and then nothing's ever done about it. So I, like I said, as long as I'm employed as a journalist, I intend to keep writing about this issue, to look at other aspects of the system that may not be working as well as we'd like.
Hi, Rob. Marilyn Seeley.
Hi, Marilyn.
Thank you very much for doing this. I think it was one of the best I've ever seen in working in this area for 30 years or more.
Thank you.
You really put it together well. Some things that I didn't know about and I've been in this business a long time, so really appreciate it. Love the fact that we have some people still doing the in-depth stories in the newspaper. I'm getting tired of sound bites, quite frankly. So I
hope there are still people doing that in the next few months.
Yeah, well, we'll watch that closely. I was a little disappointed that I didn't see more response in letters to the editor. I think there's a lot on the blog, and you say you got a lot of calls, but I had expected those pages to be just covered with people responding, and I didn't see that.
Quite frankly, I was surprised too. I mean, especially based on the feedback that I was getting. In terms of the emails, I probably got it was on average with the kind of response I would get for a four-part series, which is to say there was quite a bit of response. And then in terms of the telephone responses, I mean, it was just off the chart. But I don't know what the answer is to that. I mean, clearly there's interest out there in this topic. Clearly there are people willing to take the time to write me or call me. But why there wasn't, and I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was a situation where they got a bunch of letters to the editor and they just didn't run them. My suspicion is they didn't get very many at all. And I have no idea why that is the case.
Could I ask one favor? If I made you the long-term care commissioner today, what three or four things would you do immediately if you could do them?
Yeah, put me on the spot here. I think the first thing I would do, and there are already efforts to try and correct this, is I would take a look at the system that we have in place for discharging and placement of patients needing long-term care, because the system that we have now isn't working very well. When you have situations where there are care homes and foster homes providing kickbacks to attract business, when you have situations where there are people in the hospital who are being approached by outside caregivers or outside foster home operators, outside care home operators, and are being marketed, they're being given marketing pitches to come stay in my home, that tells you that there are the people on the outside who are getting access to confidential patient information, which is a federal violation, and they're using that information and going into the hospital and soliciting business. And that's another story, by the way, that I'm going to do, I'm going to look into. What happens is you've got placements being made into nursing homes or care homes or foster homes where the residents' needs don't really match the capability of the institution or the care home. And so what that happens is it gums up the entire system. And so I've heard of situations where someone is placed in a foster home because the foster home operator is either slipping money under the table or giving expensive gifts or knows, has some kind of family relationship or personal relationship with the people doing the discharge planning. They get the patient in their home. They're not equipped to deal with it. They're just looking at this is revenue that's going to be generated from another patient, and I've got an empty bed, and I need that revenue. So what happens is it's not a good fit at all. After a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, the foster home operator, care home operator decides, this is much more than I bargained for. They take the patient, abandon him or her at the ER, or call an ambulance and say, well, we've got a medical emergency, come get such and such. The ambulance comes, takes the patient to the ER. The hospital people say, well, there's no need for this person to be admitted. They get back on the phone, call up the care home or foster home, say, hey, can you come pick up such and such because there's no need for hospitalization. Oh, I'm sorry, the bed's already full. And so when you have situations like that happening again and again and again and again, what it does is it gums up the entire system. So even though we have like a nursing home bed shortage, for instance, you know, we may be able to address part of that if we were just more efficiently and smartly placing these people to begin with. And I think that is, of all the work I did on this series, that probably is the one problem that if we were able to resolve would have the broadest impact on freeing up some of the bed space and more smartly placing people in these care and foster homes. And not only that, it would result in better care for the patient. And that, you know, to me, it has to be the overriding objective. So that, I mean, I don't, 2, 3, and 4, I'm not sure, but that would probably be number one on my list.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Hi, I'm Audrey Kubota.
Hi.
I'd like to ask, all those telephone calls that you received, seeing as they were telephone calls as against emails, I am presuming, perhaps erroneously, that they came from older people or people not comfortable with the internet.
No, actually, it's an accurate presumption. Most of the calls I got were from older people who, some of them said they weren't comfortable using emails. And just my general take on the situation was that by and large, most of them were, you know, older generation.
Okay, then my next question is, how many of them had ever thought to contact the long-term care, the poor, overworked, overburdened long-term care ombudsman with their concerns?
Some of them, they were unaware of that office, and I directed them to that office. Some of them had already dealt with John in that office, and they were still, you know, had problems that they were contending with. And some of them, you know, I directed to other help agents, you know, like the senior hotline and things like that. Some of them were just didn't know where to turn and turned to me because I had just written this 4-part series.
So your general take is that whatever we have out there, either the word is not getting out or it's the word's been ineffective, like the ADRC.
It's clear that lots of, based on the feedback I got, that lots of people have no clue where they turn to answer questions. I mean, that is, it's absolutely clear. So the you know, some of these offices that are designed to help people answer questions and navigate, you know, they have a lot of work cut out to get the message out. And one of the things that we did with that idea in mind was we ran, on the last day of the series, we ran a resource list for people to, you know, phone numbers and websites for people to call precisely for that reason, because we knew that, you know, there was a lot of people out there that didn't know where to turn to. Jim has had his hand up for a while.
Thanks, Jim Sean. With respect to having an impact, this is a year where a slew of people are running for governor, lieutenant governor, and mayor. And I would like to see you do some follow-up interviews with them. Mm-hmm. Here's the series. Here are 5 questions based on it. You know, what would you do if you were elected or whatever? You know, that sort of thing. So it's still possible. But one of the reasons you didn't get a reaction was because the story came out the same week as Donna Kim was coming out with her Senate budget, and everybody was totally focused on would there be a GET increase or not. So it was like swept right off of the, you know, the public consciousness, you know, notwithstanding slips through the cracks, you know. Whoever made the decision had never been to the legislature and didn't know the timetable, didn't know when things get done, didn't, you know, I mean, it was just the worst possible week to run it to be the least effective, you know.
See, I plead ignorance.
I understand.
I wouldn't have given that any You know, I wouldn't have put the two together.
Yeah. However, the fact that people still are, you know, running for office, their major offices this year, it may be possible to take what you've done and to do some, you know, one-on-one interviews with all the announced candidates.
No, that's a very good idea. I mean, I'll have to make a note of that.
Well, I do also want to thank you, Rob, after working on this for 20 years, to finally see it come out in public. You mentioned sort of briefly finding problems in home care that you didn't have time to write. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the things you found, some of the problems you found?
Oh, for the in-home care?
Yeah.
Well, I'm only starting to work on that now. So, I mean, there's not really a whole lot I could share now with. And even if it's not published yet, I would be reluctant to share some of my findings for fear I might tip off a competitor. So, the journalism is a competitive business, and yeah, we don't like to tip off our competitors too much. But I don't think I view my competitor mainly as the Star Bulletin, but they don't have anyone over there who does the kind of stuff that I do. So, but there's this general reluctance to me as a journalist not to reveal too much of what I'm working on before it's published.
Okay, I'll let that go then. But
I'm looking for any feedback that you folks have for ideas of what I can look at when I'm looking at the in-home care slice of the industry.
Case managing.
Mm-hmm.
People who are give advice to people who want in-home care and where to get it. And
okay. Well, that's after the meeting. Let's talk some more. I'd be interested in hearing more about that.
The other thing I wanted to ask you was that since we're an advocacy organization, mm-hmm. we are now looking for the next year and a new governor and maybe a change of priorities at the top. What would you suggest is a single issue that all of us advocacy could work on like we did with Kupuna Care this year, which was successful? So far, what could we look forward to to suggest for next year?
Geez, I think you people would be in a much better position to answer that than me. I would think that there's so many to choose from that you just have to decide what is what is going to be your top priority. And I wouldn't want to, I think that you're in a much better position to answer that than me.
Well, if you get in on it, then we get the publicity, you know.
Rob, one of the things that I think all of us need to do as individuals, other than what we do collectively, is to try to get our families to start thinking about what it is they're going to do when we get to the point where we're going to need their help. And one of the things that we did in my family was to take an article that appeared in the Atlantic this month called, I believe it was called Letting Go of My Father, which was a case study, a beautiful case study of how a totally frustrated, frightened son had to deal with a father who was slipping into dementia and other problems. And I asked my kids to all read that story, and I asked them to think about it and to give me some response. So I think, that's one of the things that we ought to be doing with our own children.
Well, and that's something that I heard again and again and again from the families that I talked to who went through this system, navigated it for the first time, and they were telling me about their frustrations in dealing with the system. But they also were commenting that it wasn't they're not putting all of the blame on the system. They were also casting the light inward and saying, we as a family, my siblings, we didn't sit down, talk to our parents about what it is their desires were, and then as a family, talk about how we're going to try and meet those desires. And I talked to many, many people that said that once there was a crisis that they were dealing with, because if you don't go into these things adequately prepared, chances are you're going to be dealing with these very difficult issues at a time of crisis. And when that happens, it makes the potential for conflict and disagreement that much more greater. And lots of families told me that they had, you know, sibling arguments, and they had relationships that were ruined over disagreements on how to handle long-term care for mom or dad. And so their advice to me, which I included in the article on the last day, was that don't wait for a crisis to start talking about this and planning about it. Start doing that well before you actually need the service.
Thanks, Rob. I think that when you were put on the spot on what we should be putting to the legislature, why don't we just go right to what you think is the most important thing, if you were commissioner, what you would do. To me, why don't you hit right on that issue of how to separate where people go or...
Oh, right. And that's something that, I mean, even as we speak, I know the Healthcare Association of Hawaii is working with various people in the industry and with regulators to come up with a more efficient system, because they recognize that what we have now is very inefficient. And one of their proposed solutions is to develop an electronic real-time system for getting discharge information so that care providers can have access to this real-time electronic system, and it doesn't favor any one particular caregiver. And one of the problems with the current system is that because it's not automated, there is lots and lots of discretion given to the discharge planner at the hospital or to the case manager who's handling that case. And because of that, because of, you know, human nature, when you have lots of power or discretion given to a single individual, that can sometimes be decisions can sometimes be influenced by, you know, personal factors, personal gain, family relationships, friend relationships, things like that. And so one way to address that from the Healthcare Association of Hawaii's perspective is to develop a real-time electronic system that would give access to multiple caregivers, basically saying, here's a profile of a patient that's soon to be discharged. Who out there has the capacity and the staff and the training to be able to handle these types of needs? And the idea is to get as many different providers essentially making a pitch for that service, which would take some of that individual discretion out of the system. But I'm sure no matter what kind of system is put in place, there are going to be some smart people out there who figure out how to game the system. There's no perfect system.
I wanted to follow up on what you were saying to get a sense of, having gone through all these documents and people, where you feel, I mean, it's easier to get an airline, you know, book an airline ticket or a hotel and see when the seats disappear, you know, as other people are making their reservations online, sort of thing. So you have a system that is woefully overtaxed by number of people. You have people who are have a vested interest, perhaps, in the current system, and then you just have maybe this is such a low priority that people haven't figured out how to do it better, you know. Have you been able to kind of sort out in your own mind where you see the resistance is economic self-interest versus we're just so overwhelmed that it's hard to get from here to there to, gee, we never thought of that, you know?
I think it's a little bit of all three of those, but I can tell you that I talk to a lot of people, caregivers, foster home operators, care home operators, who applauded what I was doing and on an off-the-record basis was giving me information and steering me to certain documents and things, but they were absolutely terrified if their name ever got out. There are people in this, caregivers and others in the, that are working in the system that know what the problems are, but who are reluctant to come forward. I talked to one woman who operates a, I don't remember if it was a care home or foster home, and she was at a public forum advocating for reforms and certain things. But the minute you start sort of tinkering with the changing the status quo, there are going to be winners and losers. And in this community, the caregivers here are the vast majority are Filipino. And it's a very close-knit community, very word travels fast in that community. And so if a caregiver sort of steps out of line and advocates for reforming the status quo, they hear about it. And I talked to one care home provider who told me after her views were made known publicly, the next morning she walked out and the tires on her car were slashed. And that's the kind of fear that is very real out there. And so you get people that, who, although they want to reform the system, they're reluctant to step forward because of ramifications. I also talked to another, this is a case manager, runs a case management agency, and is very well respected in the healthcare community. And she started really cracking down on some of the foster homes that she dealt with who weren't doing things the way they were supposed to be doing. And she mentioned to me one example in particular. Let me see if I can recall. Oh, yeah, it was a client of hers. Basically, her business is to take these clients and place them in foster homes. And she tries to screen the foster homes and only deal with the ones that are reputable and provide good care. Well, in this case, she placed someone in a foster home, and when she had one of her nurses go, they have to do periodic visits throughout the month, and when one of her employees, a nurse consultant, was there, they noticed that the client had bed sores, but it wasn't documented on the file. And so the nurse said to the foster home operator, oh, there's a mistake here. You need to document these bed sores and place it in the file. That's a requirement. And the care home operator, the foster home operator, got upset and was resistant and was making a big stink. And within, I think it was 2 days, that case management agency that was insisting they do things by the book was fired from that case, because what happened was word got out and the foster home operator was able to persuade the patient, because the patient ultimately has the choice, the patient or the family, that, oh, this case management agency doesn't have your best interests in heart. We recommend that you go with this other case management agency who we deal with on a regular basis. And there probably was some kind of personal relationship there, and they knew that if they went with this other case management agency, the case management agency would look the other way for things like that. So here's a case where a case manager did what was the right thing and essentially got blackballed for it. And that's the kind of reality that caregivers and case managers and others are dealing with out there, and one of the reasons why it's so difficult to reform the system.
Hi, Rob. Jay Bloom. Jim mentioned gubernatorial candidates as one stakeholder group to follow up, but Tony mentioned something that triggered me, my thought about letting go of father. Not all boomers had kids, but all boomers have parents, mm-hmm. and almost all of them are still in the workforce. So it strikes me that employers are probably dealing with some of these issues as well, as employees try to struggle with caregiving issues for their older parents. So it might be interested to encourage you to follow up with some key employers and see if they're seeing that issue in the workplace.
Yeah, that's actually a number of people suggested that, and that's an area, you know, like I said at the beginning, you know, I could only cover so much, and that's one area where clearly I think it would be beneficial to look into that and to see what are employers doing, what are some of the more progressive ones doing with this issue. But it's just I didn't have time nor the space to cover it all. But that it's a very good suggestion.
Well, we've reached the time to wrap up, and I want to thank you very much, Rob, for this excellent presentation, for your series, for coming to speak to us, and I look forward to the rest in the advertiser.
If I'm still employed.
Well, that was part of it. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.